Hello everyone and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, episode 16, Enflushment. Before I start, I'm sorry, I need to ask you for a bit of money. Not for me, but for the Anthony Nolan charity. Anthony who? I hear you say. Well, Anthony Nolan play a big part in the lives of people who, like me, develop blood cancer by finding them stem cell donors. And they were important in my treatment, even though my brother was kind enough to strap himself into a chair for Lord knows how many hours and donate his stem cells to me. Anyway, Davy, I, Gilbert, Izzy and Henry are going to walk 50 miles of the Thames path from Henley to Oxford. Actually, Davy and I are doing two legs, first to make sure that my two legs are still working, and then on the 19th of June, the whole team is doing the last 23-mile slog. Davy, by the way, is the player of the podcast intro and a singer of shanties. I hope you will repay me to repay Anthony Nolan just a little for what they did for me and countless others. If you are up for it, then go to our JustGiving site at justgiving.com/fundraising/shedcasters or go to my website or Facebook site where you'll find a link. And thank you very much in advance. Right, so it seems that we have reached a sort of watershed in the life of our hero here. Just as my life can be divided into two distinct periods, before and after I won the under-12s tennis trophy for Quorn Tennis Club, so it feels as though Margaret's life can be divided into pre-Bosworth and post-Bosworth. Looking back, it is easy to see a clear dichotomy between the anxious, often wildly troubled life before her son became King Henry VII and the semi-regal life after it, where she was unassailable in her position. I hope that doesn't constitute a plot spoiler, by the way. But a word of warning. Although we know that Henry VII survived to found a Welsh dynasty that would rule England for over 100 years before the Scots picked up the baton, Henry and Margaret would have been none so sure. After all, Bosworth was just one more in a long line of battles and regime change that had bedevilled 15th century England, and so it would prove there would be another battle in 1487, for example. And after the Battle of Stoke Field that year, Margaret did not throw herself into a sofa next to Henry in front of an open fire, kick off her shoes and remark, "Well, great to see we've polished off the last battle of the Wars of the Roses then." And there would be further trouble before too long with Perkin Warbeck. The Cornish would revolt in 1497 and get jolly close to Westminster. Uncertainty and worry had not left Margaret's life, and as John Fisher remarked, she was most definitely a person for whom every silver lining had its cloud. Or at least, she was more likely to worry than celebrate victory. Having said that, 1485 was a watershed for her, and it might be worth saying the obvious about why. Mums and sons don't always have super close relationships, of course, but often they do, and in this case, they had a relationship so close that its intensity feels almost slightly, I don't know, irritating a bit, hysterical almost. It might not have inevitably been that way, but look at it from each of their points of view. From Margaret's point of view, her whole life had been spent against the background of her only son's precarious present and very dodgy-looking future. As we've discussed many times over, she had worried, she had schemed, she had plotted. She had seen Henry stand on the brink of readmittance to society and seen him on the edge of the precipice of delivery into the hands of his potential murderers. We don't need to see this in the binary context of Henry being king or dead, for much of the time Margaret's aim was simply for her son to be admitted to his birthright and to live a full and productive life of which she could be part. We need to see this in the context of the strength of Margaret's family relationships, so she fought all life long for the best outcomes of her wider family, Beaufort, Wells, St. John. But from Henry's point of view also, there's the emotional thing, sure, Alongside Jasper Tudor, his mother had been the one constant thread of emotional and practical support since he was a nipper. But there's also a practical side to this. I have often said on the History of England, I think, that personal relationships between the king and his great families were the basis of effective rule. Incompetent rulers like Edward II and Henry VI were incompetent at least in part because they messed up patronage and personal relationships. They got the balance wrong. They didn't fully understand the nuances and the networks involved. Now, when Henry VII arrived as king in 1485, his assurance in dealing with the post-conflict settlement was notable. This included not only the obvious stuff like unwinding Richard III's titulus regis or visiting acts of attainder on Richard's supporters, but it also lay in bringing people together, in placating and encouraging traditional Yorkists who had supported Edward IV but were a bit equivocal about Richard III. How much of this settlement was due to Margaret and her council is the question I put to you. Margaret had been a part of the political scene in England at the highest level, frequently seen at court, now married to one of the very highest in the land, Thomas Stanley. We know that Henry honoured his mother and that she would be at court very frequently. How important it must have been for him to be able to lean on an intelligent and experienced political operator who knew the people and their families, and yet whose loyalty to Henry was without question that he could never rely on from any other kind of nobleman. Much of this we'll never know, I guess, in detail, conversations behind closed walls and that sort of thing. But we can be sure that Henry valued Margaret's counsel through their lives, that Margaret was unashamedly supreme at court. Nicola Tallis called her biography Uncrowned Queen, and as the story will unfold, that is a very accurate description indeed. Also, there are very interesting precedents in the 15th century. So, I give you Margaret of Anjou and Cecily Neville for examination by the jury. Similar to our hero, Margaret of Anjou became her son's greatest protector and supporter. With the incapacity of her husband Henry VI, she became the centre of effective power and rule under later Lancastrian rule. The analogy isn't perfect. Unlike Beaufort, the king was for a while completely incapable, and Margaret of Anjou therefore asked specifically for full regency powers. She also lost support for seeming to lack compassion by executing Yorkists who had previously been pardoned by Henry VI after the Battle of St Albans, the Second Battle of St Albans. Cecily Neville, however, mother of Edward IV, is a much closer parallel to Margaret. She had an even stronger reputation for piety. She was a commanding presence at court. Both Edward and Richard referred to her for counsel. She also had a reputation for being a terrier in defence of her landed rights. She was a generous benefactor to education, and she used her influence to exploit wardships and protect her tenants. Cecily is a very interesting parallel with Margaret, and maybe she and Margaret hit it off in the 1470s when they were both at court. Certainly, Cecily left a breviary browned with cloth of gold for Margaret in her will, and Cecil herself was honourably dealt with by Henry VII, although probably as much because she was the grandmother of his wife, as much from Margaret's intervention. Cecily was as staunch in her championing of the family of York as Margaret was for her son. Cecily famously left Henry VII a wheel of fortune in her will when she died in 1495, a reminder for him not to get too comfortable on that throne. Anyway, it is entirely possible that Cecily impressed Margaret with her example. Well, let's get back to the narrative then, and we can see how Margaret does react to the turn of fortune's wheel. After Bosworth in August 1485, Henry trogged off down to London, as you do if you're going to claim the country, and the London streets were, of course, packed with well-wishers. You didn't last long in London without knowing which side of your bread the butter was located. We don't know if Margaret met her 28-year-old lad there in London or on the way, but it must have been quite a reunion. I'm imagining, "You all right?" "Yeah, I'm all right." "You all right?" "Cool." The lever of the one-armed bandit had been well and truly pulled for Margaret, and before Henry's coronation, the trust between mother and son was apparent. Margaret was given a vast house from which to base herself in London, Cold Harbour House, and was immediately entrusted with the guardianship of some critical people, namely Elizabeth Woodville, Elizabeth of York, the Yorkist candidate for the throne, the Earl of Warwick, Edward Stafford, the young Duke of Buckingham. But Margaret didn't spend all her time there in London. No, indeed, she must have spent some time in September 1485 at her old stamping ground at Woking, and with her son again. You might remember that in the happy days of Henry VI's second gasp, she'd had her son with her before he went off to Wales. Now, I do not know, but I would bet a pound to a penny, that Beaufort and Sons were as thick as thieves as the messengers and well-wishers came and went, and that the results of their fireside chats could be seen at the forthcoming coronation in Parliament. But the help that Henry's mother was able to give her son was practical as well as in terms of advice. So, as the king formed his own household, he was able to draw on a competent set of administrators in Margaret's household, over which she had kept stern control. So included in this was Reginald Bray, for example, Margaret's right-hand man, who went on quickly to work in Henry's service. Well, the coronation was, of course, as much a victory party as a coronation. The virtuous were front of stage at said post-match party, such as the ever-loyal Jasper Tudor, who, after a couple of decades of loyal service, finally cashed in his chips as Duke of Bedford, with marriage also to Catherine Woodville, and he was given the honour of carrying the crown. Thomas Stanley also found himself in receipt of goodies, although William Stanley, oddly, probably felt that although he had been rewarded, that couldn't be described as lavish, which is interesting. Margaret, of course, turned on the waterworks, and you'd had to have been made of stone not to have done the same had you been Margaret. When the king, her son, was crowned in all that great triumph and glory, she wept marvellously. At the following Parliament, from November to December, there was further redress for Henry's followers. But maybe we can also see the influence of his mother, or at least the strategy of a Cecily Neville rather than a Margaret of Anjou. For restoration was made to many who had suffered under Richard III, who were staunch Yorkists. Just as Margaret has suggested the idea of marrying Elizabeth of York to help bring Lancaster and York together, so she made sure that Henry's victory did not lead to a bloodbath. Margaret also played a part in this. For example, she found space in her household for one Ralph Biggard, a former knight of the body to Richard III. The Parliament did all the business stuff as well. Henry declared himself king by right rather than king by conquest. Richard's titulus regis was repealed. But the other casher in of chips was, of course, Mum. And this was achieved in a rather remarkable way. My Lady the King's mother, as she was to be styled, was declared to be a femme sole. This was a quite remarkable move and is worth describing briefly. In the medieval world, once married, a woman's legal status was described as a femme couverte. The origin of this seems to have been somewhere in the legal reforms of Henry II. The principle in law was that the husband and wife became one, which all sounds very equitable, does it not? But in practice, was of course absolutely not, because the single person concerned turned out to be the bloke, all the woman's goods. And a femme couverte could not own property, she could not sign legal documents, nor could she enter into a contract or keep a salary for herself. If she did earn a bob or two, she'd have to turn it over to hubby. But there was another legal status available for women, which was the femme sole. This was almost always seen as driven by economic reasons, very often adopted by widows or some single women in towns who were in control of a business and needed to exist legally, as it were, to be able to make contracts and all that sort of thing. Margaret's situation, though, was very non-standard. She was a married woman, for crying out loud. This was a social revelation, the kind of thing that makes Colonel Mustard spill his G&T with horror. The femme sole thing seems to me to be absolutely fundamental to understanding Margaret's attitude towards the rest of her life. This may be partly that so far she'd exercised horribly little control over her life, or indeed it could be that she had tried very hard to exercise control on occasion and found the situation, after the Buckingham Rebellion had failed, personally humiliating. Is it possible to be cross and not being executed because you're not seen as legally responsible? But the real thing, I think, is that Margaret Beaufort considered herself to be a queen in every way, and that she should be not only in control of her own destiny, but in control of her community's destiny as a natural leader of society. After all, her claim to the throne was stronger than that of her sons. There is no prospect in which Margaret would have asserted her rights over her sons, given everything her life had been about, and what the politics of that would have been. But nonetheless, she felt her lineage in her very water. I wonder in this what Thomas Stanley thought, Mr. Margaret Beaufort, that is. You might well say, well, who cares, but it might have been hard for him to live with. Or maybe not. Margaret was now the king's mother, so with or without the femme sole thing, she had the superior social status to her husband, and precedence really mattered back then. Precedence mattered in spades, with brass shiny knobs on. But Margaret's new legal status resulted also in a detailed arrangement with Stanley about how much of his wife's income he would now get, which was between one-third and two-thirds of Margaret's existing estates, but absolutely zip of any grants made to Margaret since 1485. From Henry's point of view, this approach had a triple benefit. He was already in the process of rewarding Stanley anyway, and he had no desire to give him even more through Margaret. It meant that his grants to Mum now would go straight to her. And it meant that, longer term, any grants to Margaret would not be alienated permanently from the Crown, because when she died, they'd then revert to the Crown. The grant to Margaret came in the Great Grant of 1487, so it took a couple of years to come through. The substantial estates she received generated additional income of over £1,000 a year, which lifted her total income in 1488 to £2,000, which put her up with the richest magnates in the land. And the grants were concentrated in the West Country, and, most importantly, in the Midlands, where Henry would have plans for his mother. This, of course, was no more, surely, than just desserts for Margaret, payback time. But just before you break out into cheers, start scattering the confetti and hang out the bunting on the Siegfried line, there is just a soupçon of a hard edge. Margaret's benefit in terms of grants came at the expense of others who had been hoping for royal favour. One notable example of this is the Marquis of Dorset, Elizabeth Woodville's son by her first marriage, who had wobbled and tried, though failed, to leave the Tudor camp at Brittany. He was now suspect and would not really be trusted by Henry before his death in 1501. As with a few things with Margaret, it is important at all times to remember that she is no pushover. Anyway, Margaret had been fully enflushed and was ready to join her son at court. And there, another important figure was to join them. Henry had adopted the policy of marriage to Elizabeth of York at Margaret's suggestion. And now, in a rather obvious piece of theatre, at the end of Parliament, Henry was begged by his people to marry her. To everyone's amazement, not. He graciously accepted. Wow. OK, so next time, Margaret and the new Tudor court. Shy and retiring, or giving it large? You guess.